The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, starting to settle in for sitting. And just feeling the body first in the sitting posture. As we orient ourselves to meditation, we're going to direct our attention just a little bit to help settle the body and the mind. So perhaps feeling the place where you're sitting, your seat against the chair or the cushion or the bed, and your legs or your feet against the floor or touching each other. And just having a sense of balance where you're sitting. So finding a position for the body, maybe even moving back and forth slightly or forward and back slightly to find a center point where you feel balanced, upright, easeful. It's very helpful for this practice to be relaxed, balanced. And then allowing the body to soften, softening the face, softening the jaw, letting the shoulders drop away from the ears. Softening down through the torso area, the chest, the belly. Allowing the arms and legs to be relaxed. It's often useful to think in terms of just inviting ease through the body. It's very difficult to relax when we're commanding the body to relax, so we just invite ease. And if any parts remain tense or sore or difficult to experience right now, that's fine. We just have mental ease about how the body is right now. And then with some degree of physical ease, we can open awareness to the mind. How is the mind right now? How is the heart? Is there a dominant mood? How is the energy level? A little bit agitated, busy still, or a little dull, tired at the end of the day? All of that is fine also. We just want to be aware. Just establishing a simple receptive awareness in the mind. A willingness to meet experience just how it is right now. Checking to see if we're wanting something right now, wanting peace after a busy day, wanting a certain sound to go away in the background. or if we're hoping something won't happen. I hope that headache I had earlier isn't going to return now. And just being aware of these movements in the mind so that they don't color how we see experience. Just bringing a simple awareness. Open awareness to how things are. And remembering also that when we are aware of something like greed or hatred or delusion in the mind, the awareness is not partaking of that. So it's fine. In a sense, it's been diffused if we're aware of it. So feeling into the simple kindness of this practice. What a gift to simply have an open awareness of experience. And continuing to practice in this way. Okay, so welcome. Nice to see you. So I wanted to reflect a bit this evening on what the Buddha meant by freedom. And this came about because freedom is a word that is used quite frequently in our society, and it's given a lot of value. But it actually has different flavors in Buddhism compared to, say, in the political sphere or something else. So I'm going to talk mostly about what the Buddha meant or how we can practice for that, let me say. But I do want to make this comparison with more commonly understood ideas of the word freedom. So I think we could say that modern societies are generally concerned with freedom. You know, we value liberties like freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom to pursue our interests within legal means. And so we're willing to defend, you know, those freedoms and what they mean. And so all of these are, they amount to what's called the freedom of license in behavior and in speech and in thought. And it's assumed that people will be happier when they have greater freedom of license. And that's true to some degree. These kinds of freedom are humane, and they offer people the dignity of fashioning their own lives within their circumstances. We can certainly say that tyrannical systems maintain their power by limiting people's freedom of license. So, you know, according this kind of freedom its due respect, when I reflect on it, I don't think this is what the Buddha meant by freedom exactly. He was also concerned with liberating people from tyrannical systems, but he really pointed to our own mind as the source of the tyranny. So we may notice in meditation that we're sometimes obsessed with repeating thoughts or with painful emotions, or we're driven by compulsive wants, or we have, you know, we're sort of in the sway of distorted views. And when we can see that this is what's going on, we can also see quite clearly that we are not free in moments like that. So maybe we could say that these various troublesome mind states have been given too much freedom of license in our minds. So the Buddha offered training in what could be called something different, something like the freedom of mastery or the freedom of skillfulness. And we get this by practicing in line with what the Buddha taught. So maybe we don't like the word master so much, but there isn't any master behind the freedom of mastery. And it's also not about doing a technique or controlling the mind. Now that's kind of another kind of tyranny, is when we do a control-oriented way of practice and we think that we're going to get our mind in shape, get it in line. I know that sometimes when people first try to be aware continuously throughout the day, as Utejaniya suggests, they can get tied up in a controlling attitude that is actually exhausting for the mind. So that's not quite what this freedom of mastery or freedom of skillfulness means. I think we could instead say it means something like a very competent knowing. So Like if somebody is a master chess player, you wouldn't be able to do kind of a simple deceptive trick on them in a chess game. They would know. Or if somebody has mastery in cooking, they're not going to burn a meal. Or a master gardener knows very clearly what is a weed and what isn't a weed, what's a useful plant, whereas someone who isn't a master might not know that. So we're talking about mental mastery then, somehow mastery of our minds. We're becoming kind of a master of knowledge internally. But interestingly, to do that, there are some restrictions that are necessary. We have to limit certain freedoms of license, like, you know, for example, ethical behavior is essentially a containment or a prescribing of our behavior and speech and even thought in ways that are skillful. That's what we could call ethical conduct. And then we train our awareness to be more and more continually present, but to be connected with wisdom. You know, we're not just having any old kind of attention to experience. We cultivate having mindfulness that's infused with wisdom and with the right attitude about what we're experiencing. And it turns out that just by opening to experience and being willing to notice the defilements like greed, hatred, and delusion, to see them clearly, we are less and less subject to their tyranny. We don't have to do a lot with them. If we can just be aware of them, then they don't have the upper edge anymore. And in fact, our clear awareness of them starts to transform how the mind operates slowly over time. I think many of you have seen this just from your own practice already. So this is one of the Buddha's main teachings about, if you will, mastering our own mental patterns, not by controlling them, but by seeing them so that we are not controlled by them. And when we revoke this freedom of license, if you will, from our defilements, then the fruit is wisdom, you know, a deep understanding of how suffering operates in the mind and not getting fooled by that quite as often. Of course, it's a long-term process, but we don't get fooled quite as often. And so then I think we become increasingly empowered. You know, we feel increasingly empowered as we develop the Buddhist path because we don't have anything to fear from our own heart anymore. And other people can feel that too. They feel that they don't have so much to fear from us either. So we're no longer frittering our energy away into things like conflicts or selfish desires or fixed ideologies or confusion. And then when we're not frittering our energy away like that, we're more liberated to take useful action, both in the world and on the cushion. So in a sense, we're disempowering our tyrannical mind states in order to find more ease and joy. Not that it's always pleasant, of course, but the joy of the path is a delight in knowing, in awareness, regardless of what is known. So I think ironically, you know, we very much value and associate our political freedom with having choice, a lot of choice in what we do. It might be that the liberated mind in the Buddhist sense experiences less choice in some ways. Like the way water flowing downhill doesn't make any choices. It's just flowing downhill. Life is just unfolding, if we're thinking of it in this analogy. So choice involves some mental deliberation, a certain amount of effort. And sometimes, you know, sometimes that's what's called for. And if that's the case, then we have clear discernment coming forth. But after we've practiced for a while, especially with this kind of open awareness, receptive awareness to our life unfolding, it seems like fewer situations need a lot of deliberation. You know, we've made our choice for integrity, for compassion, for kindness, for clarity. Those are what we orient around. And so the path becomes more straightforward. So the mind that is operating with some kind of mastery over its own scattering forces is learning to operate in a different way. And we're kind of tapping into a natural order that is characterized more by peace in whatever we're doing, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, or, you know, we're interacting with people or we're quiet. There's this underlying kind of natural sense of peace with that. I think about the exposition of the elements, Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and it says, this is the supreme noble peace, namely the pacification of greed, hatred, and delusion. So eventually we're moving toward a case where we're not fooled by the mind's own imaginations or conceivings or conceptualizations, all the stories that we tell about ourselves and about the future. And that same sutta says, when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over a practitioner, one is called a sage at peace. So then we're living in a more straightforward way, not so much pretense, not so much contrivance, not so much fear or compulsion. So the mind becomes more flexible, more resilient. We don't get caught by these tides of conceiving. So we can see that this freedom of mastery or freedom of awareness, peace that comes in this way is very, it's just a different realm than this idea of the freedom of license, where the idea is that we want to be able to do as much as possible. Instead, we kind of limit the tyranny of greed, hatred, and delusion. And then there's this naturalness to what we do that doesn't require so much choice, really. It's interesting. It's subtle. I hope I conveyed it in some way that's at least intriguing, useful. But this has been on my mind as we read about, you know, so much of the world suffering and wishing for more freedom for people so they weren't subject to tyrannical systems. And yet knowing also that our practice is, a slightly different flavor of that somehow. And you know, learning how to negotiate that in our lives. Being a practitioner in a world where not everyone practices, and yet what we do is so beneficial. But it's important to be clear about the terms, and in particular, we look today at this term, liberation or freedom. So I actually just had these few brief thoughts. I think that's kind of what was on my mind and heart. And I'd like to hear from you and see if you have any questions or comments or anything about your practice that's coming up. Let's talk. Okay, I see your note, Ollie. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Do you feel like as you do your practice that you have less tyranny from greed, hatred, and delusion? Yeah, I see a couple of nods. Yeah. It's a long process. I want to be clear about that, and takes a little bit of humor as we watch our poor mind flopping around sometimes. But there certainly can be a sense of liberation from those forces. Sometimes, moments throughout the day. Maybe we could say a little bit more about this idea of choice or choicelessness. For sure, when the mind is wrapped up in some kind of obsession or wanting or not wanting or something, for sure it's not free at that moment. You know, we can feel that it doesn't really have much choice. Sometimes these habits are called, well, habits or mental patterns. You know, you see that some situation comes up and the mind is reacting in its habitual way, like there's the sound of your neighbor out doing something in the backyard and making noise, and they do that every day, and you've developed this habit where as soon as you hear that sound, there's a sense of aversion in the mind. And so it feels almost automatic, you know, Pavlovian in a sense, psychological. And there's so the mind isn't free when it has a sense stimulus, and then the next thing that happens is already, it's just automatically conditioned. There's aversion when I hear that sound. And we can start to see those patterns as if we, you know, we do mindfulness practice, we start to realize, oh, that's happening each time. And, you know, beforehand, it was just unfolding and we were just caught up in it. But when we start to see it, then it's true that, and this is the language that's often used in mindfulness training, is that when we start to see that that pattern happens, there's a moment where we have more choice. And we're told that mindfulness creates choices for us in those gaps between the arising of something and the automatic reaction. We can see into that gap between them and have a choice, have a chance to do something else. So I want to be clear that I'm not what I was saying about choicelessness wasn't undermining that idea. That is very real. I can think of many times where mindfulness saved me from saying something that probably wouldn't have been so good to say, or even from falling into, you know, just a mind state that I, you know, that wouldn't have been productive. It would have gone off for 30 seconds on something that only detracted from my enjoyment of that moment. So for sure, mindfulness does create choice in that sense. But I guess I was referring to a case where we don't need to make the effort of choice. So sometimes Utejaniya talks about how when we're on a skateboard and we push for a while, we make some effort for a while, and then we can just be on the skateboard and just coast for a while, and there's something natural that goes on. And we're still, you know, we're still aware, we're still on the skateboard, we know what we're doing, but we're not having to continually use our foot all the time. So this is this difference between practice that has a little bit of effort in it, which we do need to do. I think he calls it personal effort, where sometimes we, and there, those are cases where we hear the sound and we go, not going to get angry. You know, we feel that choice. Yes, I can make another choice. but there's a little sense of effort there. And then there comes a time where we're not making personal effort anymore. We do what he calls effortless effort. And that's when the skateboard is just rolling along. And it can get like that. And there's almost even more freedom in that. Because when we have the case of personal effort and ourself making a decision or making a different choice, we're still a little bit in the realm of myself. You know, what is it that I want in this moment? Or what is it that I need to do? There's just a little bit of that in there. And even if we have two or three options, there's still a little bit of energy going into that. Whereas I'm now going to point to this effortless effort. I remember a time when I was in high school. It was even before I was practicing. And a friend of mine who was fairly emotional person, like she often was kind of dramatic in her emotions, and we were in a situation where we were standing with a group of people and somebody told her some news that was a little bit surprising or shocking, and she kind of froze. Like it wasn't, yeah, she froze. She got caught in a mental pattern and she sort of went into shock. Like she said, oh really? And I could see that, you know, she was getting caught up, and if she, that were to continue, her mind was just going to spin off, because I knew her pretty well. And I can't explain why I did what I did, but I put my arm around her shoulder and I said, come on, let's walk. And we just walked slowly away from the group, which was kind of caught up in its own energy, and they hadn't quite seen the impact on my friend of what had been said. And she just kind of followed along with me because she was a little bit in shock. And later she thanked me for just removing her from the situation. She was not really in a position to make a choice like that herself. But I can't, it felt to me like some force that wasn't me just sort of swept in, and I put my arm around her and walked away. I didn't think about, okay, what would be a good thing to do here? You know, maybe she needs to not be here. There wasn't any of that. It was just like a smooth act of compassion. You know, it was just compassion acting through me at that moment. So I would call that effortless effort and no choice, the choicelessness of water flowing downhill. I just did what needed to be done in that moment without thinking about whether it was in line with my character or thinking about, you know, whatever. We've probably all had moments like that where we, something came forth that was just right. And we can't make it happen. It's a little bit like a moment of grace. But I think practice points us toward more such moments being able to arise because the mind is actually free in order that it doesn't have to make a choice. It just does what's best in that moment. So I hope that gives some clarity around the different ideas of choice, the not choice at all of being in the grip of a pattern, the choice of mindfulness where we have a self there making a different choice, and then the choicelessness again of nature. Just acting with wisdom or compassion coming forth in the moment spontaneously. And we live our lives flowing between these, of course, but, you know, just to do the best we can. Comments, questions? Is this bringing up anything? Did you have any moments of freedom today? I see some smiles. Anything you want to share from your day? Yeah, Bess.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, Bess.
Well, I just want to thank you and Diane and Gil and the other teachers. I'm a tax accountant, so Monday of last week was the end of tax season, and it's pretty intense. And I have 300 clients, so it's really intense. And it was the best tax season I've had in 40 years. And I completely credit the study of the Dharma.
Wow.
With that, absolutely, 100%. Because when things happen, you know, little difficulties, it's like the right thing to do is kind of shiny. And I just need to go in that direction. So I don't always, of course, I don't probably usually even follow that, but it's really obvious what the, not correct, but what the skillful thing to step into would be. Like if I'm avoiding answering someone's email, the skillful thing is to relax and do it because it's the next thing on the list. And if I relax and do the next thing on the list, everything goes smoothly. It's when you avoid certain people that then it becomes a problem because you didn't answer their email today and maybe you don't answer their email tomorrow. And then it's a problem because you haven't gotten back to them. But anyway, just to start over, I just want to thank all the teachers, especially you, Diana, and Gil, for just a fabulous, fabulous season. It was very satisfying.
Wow, this is great to hear. I love how practice just helps whatever it is that we're doing in life. And I bet your clients, even though they don't know why it was a better tax season for them, had a better time also. And because of your mind, you know, because of your mind, just be more aware, more calm, more mindful, at least somewhat at times.
Yeah.
This is great. This is how the practice works, kind of mysteriously, but it just shows up like at times like this. This is great.
Yeah, in real life.
In real life, it's real. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's very beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Okay, well, it's about half past, so it's lovely to see all of you, and we can end here after our hour.